Lee Harvey Oswald never went to Irving on Thursday, never. But on this Thursday, November 21st, he did. He asked a co-worker at the Texas School Book Depository, Buell Wesley Frazier, for a lift. Now, as we've established throughout this series, Oswald was a habitual liar, and on this day, he told a whopper to Frazier.
Well, he come to me the Thursday, November the 21st, and asked me could he ride home with me that afternoon. And I said, well, yes. And I said, well, why are you going home this afternoon? And he replied that he wanted to go home and pick up some curtain rods where he could put some curtains up in his apartment.
Curtain rods? Oswald's room already had curtains, but who would know that? Ruth Payne, who was sheltering Oswald's estranged wife, Marina, and their two daughters, did have two curtain rods in her garage, but they were still there after the assassination. Plus, no curtain rods were ever discovered in the book depository. Lee Harvey Oswald was not going to Irving for curtain rods. It was a lie. In fact, on this evening, November 21st, 1963, he went to retrieve something else, his rifle. I'm Paul Brandish. You're listening to Countdown to Dallas, a podcast series based on my book of the same title. The curtain rod story is representative of an important theme that I've stressed throughout this series. Oswald was a habitual liar. Prior episodes revealed numerous falsehoods, both big and small, told to family, employer, strangers, just about everyone. And so he showed up, unannounced and unwanted, at the home of Ruth Payne, who decades later told me the story, her memory still razor sharp.
He had never come out on a weeknight, and he'd always asked permission to come out for the weekend. He usually came out Friday. So this was very unusual.
But you didn't think, obviously, other than the fact that it was a Thursday, you didn't certainly didn't know that he had anything on his mind other than just coming out to see the kids.
No, I didn't. On the Monday night, Marina and he had argued over the telephone, and I thought maybe he was coming out to try to patch things up or something like that, but that was a wild guess on my part and not accurate.
Well, he did try and patch things up, but she didn't want to have anything to do with it, right?
Yeah, true. That's what I heard.
In fact, Oswald wanted to reconcile with Marina. He didn't like that his wife and two daughters were living with Ruth, who took them in and was improving her Russian while Marina improved her English. But reconcile, Marina was fed up. Oswald, after all, was abusive, a wife beater, a poor provider. Historian Stephen Beschloss is the author of The Gunman and His Mother.
But he struggled. I mean, he struggled to keep a job and make ends meet. And he increasingly took it out on Marina. So there's a lot of talk. It's Priscilla McMillan Johnson, you know, in her book, writes a lot about the abuse and how much of the beatings were going on. Times when Marina would come to see Marguerite, the mother, and she'd have bruises, you know, she'd have a black eye and so on.
In a February 1964 news conference, Marina was asked about her husband's penchant for violence. Her English back then was poor, so listen closely.
Was your husband an angry man? Did you find him an angry man or a violent man toward many people?
Angry. He was normal.
He seemed normal to you?
Yes, sometimes he was normal.
He was normal, she said, sometimes. This was a destructive cycle. This wife beater who couldn't hold a job, he had been canned twice in just the past few months alone, would attack Marina, sometimes viciously, and then try and make up. New to America and unable to speak English, Marina had few options. Ruth Payne was a lifeline, but now Oswald wanted his wife back. He was on his best behavior on the evening of the 21st and helped Ruth carry in groceries from her car. At one point in Russian, she mentioned that the president was coming to town, but Oswald did not respond.
Were you surprised when he said that our president is coming to town and he didn't really respond? Is that surprising to you?
No, he wasn't very talkative or communicative. And we were passing each other carrying groceries. I mean, we were in the process of, I was going out the door and he was coming in with things. And he just wasn't, he didn't talk a lot. So it didn't seem surprising.
Marina, meanwhile, made no effort to greet him. He tried to kiss her. She turned away. She asked, "Why are you here?" Oswald said he wanted to make up. He said if Marina would come back, listen to this, he would rent an apartment in Dallas for them the next day, November 22nd. Marina said no. He would try again later, only to be rejected yet again. The significance of this has been discussed for years. Oswald wanted to reunite with Marina, the pretty 22-year-old Soviet woman who had borne him two girls. But Marina had had enough of her husband's atrocious behavior, the beatings, the lies, the living in near poverty, the Walker shooting, the bizarre airplane hijack scheme. Enough. Marina Oswald no longer needed her husband. Was this the final blow for Oswald? In his magnificent 1967 book, The Death of a President, William Manchester writes, quote, "That may well have been the breaking point for Oswald. He had nothing left, not even pride," unquote. Marina said her husband stopped talking, watched TV, and then went to bed. Gerald Posner is the author of 1993's Case Closed.
I think that that night before he goes off the next day to kill a president, takes the rifle in the morning. He has that discussion. Marina, come back with me. I've saved up enough money that I can buy you, you know, and
let's get an apartment today. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And is it, and I don't know the answer to this. Nobody will ever know. Is it a fake offer? If she said yes, was he still going off to kill the president? Or is it possible if she had, and you know what? I'm not putting the blame for the president being dead on her, but if she had said yes, was it something that he might not have done? Now, most people, if they don't understand Oswald, can't fathom the idea that the killing of a president could have hinged on something that seems so wildly insignificant as to whether your wife was going to get back together with you. But with Oswald, you can't be sure.
No, we can't be sure. We can be sure, however, that at some point that evening, Oswald went into the Payne garage. Ruth Payne told me years later that later that evening, she also went into the garage.
You went out to the garage around 9 o'clock that night, and you were painting some lacquer blocks for the kids, and you saw that the light in the garage was on. What did you make of the light being on in the garage?
Well, I assumed that Lee had been out there. And just forgot to turn it off. I didn't think Marina would do that. So it just seemed unusual and, thought maybe he might be distracted or something.
Distracted or something. Again, we know Oswald did not go into the garage for curtain rods, and I'm getting ahead of the narrative here, but we also know that the next afternoon, as police swarmed the Payne residence, that Oswald's rifle was missing. It was only then that Ruth Payne, a Quaker, learned that Oswald even had a rifle.
You obviously had no idea what he had in the garage. Had you had known that he had that weapon in the garage prior to that, what might you have done?
Well, I certainly would have told him to keep it somewhere else. I didn't want it in the building. But it's hard to know what I would have done.
Yeah.
Crushing to know that he did have a gun and came out with an excuse about he was coming out to get curtain rods to put up in his apartment, which was totally false. I didn't have curtain rods.
The presence of the rifle was, as Norman Mailer wrote in Oswald's tale, quote, Marina's dirty little secret. Marina Oswald would testify in 1964 that her husband seemed upset that evening, upset that she wasn't interested in getting an apartment with him. It's her recollection that he turned in around 9 p.m. She went to bed around 11:30, but she said, quote, it seemed to me that he was not really asleep, but I didn't talk to him, unquote.
He was getting close to the end of his rope.
Dr. Larry Sabato is a professor at the University of Virginia and the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Kennedy Half Century.
Things were pretty much already over with Marina. Yeah. And he was getting loads of criticism from anybody he encountered because he was such a jerk, frankly. And so there were lots of hints there that something awful was going to happen.
More Countdown to Dallas right after this quick break. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Hi, folks. Paul Brandis here, the host of Countdown to Dallas on Evergreen. With Factor, you can choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, that's my favorite, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feeling good all day long. What are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for your springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's 39 ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. And if you're looking for gourmet meals, try meals from Factor that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. All you do is heat and savor the good stuff. They're also tailored to your schedule. Customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Just pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for our lowest carbon footprint meals. All you do here, head to factormeals.com/countdown50 and use code countdown50, that's the number 50, to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code countdown50 at factormeals.com/countdown50 to get half off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Welcome to Anthology of Heroes, the podcast that explores the most pivotal moments of history through the eyes of those who lived it. In this podcast, we don't spend our time recounting facts and dates. Instead, we follow in the footsteps of national heroes, kings, or ordinary people who lived and breathed the moments that shaped our world. We're not hemmed in by eras, borders, or religions. Instead, we seek out the tales of those who defied the odds and fought passionately for their beliefs. Whether they're right or wrong is up to you to decide. From Vercingetorix's doomed rebellion against Rome, to Osceola's unshakable war against the USA, all the way up to the inspiring Sobibor concentration camp uprising in World War II, each episode is an immersive listening experience, blending music and sound effects to really draw you into the story. Our episodes go for about 45 minutes, making them perfect for your commute, and are crafted using a wealth of historical sources, which I list on our website if you want to learn more. I'm the host, Elliot Gates, and I'm thrilled to have you joining me as we uncover history's hidden gems and illuminate the faded pages of our past. Look out for the Anthology of Heroes podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or anywhere else you get your podcasts from.
President and Mrs. Kennedy, meanwhile, were now 240 miles away in Houston. While everyone wanted to see the president, the star of the show was Jacqueline Kennedy. On this evening, the final night she would have with her husband, the father of her two children, she was radiant. She had never been to Texas before, and things were going well. At a gathering of Latino officials, she wowed the room.
Estoy muy contenta.
But Jacqueline Kennedy, fluent in Spanish, had trouble memorizing her words. She told her husband, quote, "I must be cracking up." She wondered if the August death of her son Patrick had damaged her ability to focus. The Kennedys then went to a dinner in honor of Houston Congressman Albert Thomas. It seems that Thomas, who had been in Congress since 1937, was thinking of retiring. This led President Kennedy to make a joke that would soon seem rather eerie.
When I read the report that Congressman Thomas was thinking of resigning, I called him up on the phone and asked him to stay as long as I stayed. I didn't know how long that would be, but
I wanted him to stay as long as I stayed. I didn't know how long that would be. Wow. The Kennedy Party then left Houston. On the ride to the airport, the president and Mrs. Kennedy were joined in their car by John Jones, publisher of the Houston Chronicle, and his wife, Freddie. Now, remember, Jackie was already nervous about Dallas, and Freddie didn't help things when she said that Dallas was, quote, really a terrible town. At the airport, Marty Underwood, a Democratic Party advance man, watched as JFK shook hands with his police escort, a Kennedy custom. The next day, Underwood, thinking of that moment, realized how vulnerable the president was on that dark airstrip. And then they were off on the short hop to Fort Worth, Air Force One touching down just after 11 p.m. Despite the late hour and a light rain, an estimated 10,000 people lined the motorcade route into town. The Kennedys made their way through a sea of well-wishers into the Hotel Texas, it's now a Hilton, and made their way to Suite 850. There was a more elaborate suite, the Will Rogers Suite, on the 13th floor, but the Secret Service determined that Suite 850 would be more secure. One agent, Muggsy O'Leary, saw a figure on the roof of a building across from the president's suite. He told a policeman to shoo him away. So the first day of the Texas trip was over and had gone without a hitch. Asked how things were going, Jacqueline Kennedy, through her spokeswoman, issued a statement. Quote, Thursday was a wonderful day, she said. Texas friendliness was everything I'd heard it to be. In their suite, the president praised his wife. You were great today, he said. How do you feel? Oh, gosh, the first lady said. I'm exhausted. She then laid out her outfit for the next day, her pink and navy Chanel suit, white gloves, and pink pillbox hat. The Kennedys might have missed a message posted in the room for all guests. It said, Hotel Texas, checkout time is 12:30 p.m. If you plan to stay after this time, please contact assistant manager. While they slept, the men entrusted with their safety decided to blow off steam. Nine agents and members of the White House press corps headed to the nearby Fort Worth Press Club where beer and cocktails were served. Every single one of these agents, the Warren Commission found out, had duty assignments beginning no later than 8 o'clock that morning. Among this contingent were four agents who were scheduled to ride in the Dallas motorcade, now just hours away, and at various times they were also joined by three agents of the midnight to 8 shift, agents officially on duty. As Manchester notes in The Death of a President, these agents were, quote, assigned to guard the president's bedroom door and who chose to break the boredom of sentry duty in this fashion, unquote. Affidavits show that some agents spent anywhere from 30 to 90 minutes there. Two went back to the hotel. But seven went on to a place called The Cellar, described as everything from a music venue to a coffee house to an all-night beatnik joint, where one of the main attractions were waitresses who wore nothing but their underwear. Officially, The Cellar did not serve alcohol, but one man who knew The Cellar well, in fact was there that night in the early hours of November 22nd, says that unofficially, The Cellar did serve alcohol. Bob Schieffer, the prominent CBS News anchor and correspondent, was back then a local reporter in Fort Worth who had just gotten off working the late shift. Schieffer told me a few years ago that The Cellar's owner, a former stock car racer named Pat Kirkwood, would serve friends Kool-Aid spiked with grain alcohol. This drink, the specialty of the house, came to be known as the Salty Dick. Two agents who would ride in the Dallas motorcade just hours later were served this concoction. One was Clint Hill, who claims he didn't finish his drink and went back to the hotel around 2:45. And in an affidavit dated December 9, 1963, Agent Paul Landis acknowledged having two of these drinks and staying till 5 a.m. 5 a.m. As they left the club, agents might have seen a sign on the wall that said, "Tomorrow is canceled." Meanwhile, just 25 miles to the east, in a small, crowded bedroom on a quiet street in Irving, it was almost time for Lee Harvey Oswald to get up. If you like this podcast, check out my book of the same title, Countdown to Dallas. Thanks to Ruth Payne, Stephen Beschloss, Larry Sabato, Gerald Posner, and Bob Schieffer. Sound from C-SPAN, CBS News, and the John F. Kennedy Presidential Library and Museum. Our editor and producer, Aaron Land. Audio engineer, Sean Rule Hoffman. Executive producers, Michael DeAloia and Gerardo Orlando. I'm Paul Brandis. Thanks so much for listening.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of the new Medal of Honor podcast from Evergreen Podcasts, brought to you in partnership with the National Medal of Honor Museum. In each three-minute episode, we'll learn about a different service member who distinguished him or herself through an act of valor. We'll include stories from the Civil War to Iraq and Afghanistan, and from all branches of the military. We'll talk about service members who were overlooked for the medal at first due to their race or religion, and about those who were celebrated at the time. We'll hear stories of soldiers like Audie Murphy, future Hollywood star who mounted a burning tank to hold off German infantry in World War II, and people like Dr. Mary Edwards Walker, a Civil War Army doctor and the only woman to receive the Medal of Honor so far. Learn about these heroes and more wherever you get your podcasts.